Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Digital, analog, long-playing records, cassettes, how do they bring sound to our ears? Well, in this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with audio engineer and producer Greg McVicker, one of the first independent radio producers to convert to digital audio technology. Greg McVicker produces a daily five-hour eclectic mix of music that may be found at undercurrentsradio.net. And you can also find Interesting Radio at his personal website, which is radiocamp.com. Greg McVicker holds a master's degree from the Annenberg School for Communications and is an adjunct professor at the California College of Arts in Oakland, California. When Greg McVicker visited the studios of Radio Curious on August 11th, 2008, we began our conversation that went to many different places when I asked him to explain the difference between analog and digital. Greg McVicker, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you.
So, you've been working in public radio for many years, and part of a change in which you were involved is changing from the technical process of analog recording to the process of digital recording.
That's right.
Can you tell us the difference between analog and digital for people who may not be familiar with the technical terms?
Well, your listeners may be familiar with, they may use digital products all the time and not think about it too much, iPods, telephones, things like that. But for us radio people, it makes a difference because we're the ones that have to get in there and edit the tape and make the sounds come to folks. And it's sort of like cooking, you know, there's a lot of chopping and mixing and baking and things like that. And the difference between analog and digital is enormous from that standpoint. The fact of the matter is right now we're using a mix, a hybrid of both analog and digital right now in this recording. For example, these microphones, the preamps, things like that are all still analog. What that means is that when we talk, for example, our vocal cords set up vibrations in the air, pressure variations in the air, a sort of a modulation of the atmosphere, which these pressure waves move along like ripples through the air and hit your eardrum, and it vibrates with those pressure waves, and then there's a little connection between your eardrum and your nervous system that converts that into a little electrical pulses, okay, which your brain interprets as sound. So this is how the analog world works, is creating analogies or analogs of real organic sound and turning them into electrical impulses and then back again. So let's say you're playing the tuba, I record you and it goes into electronic form. There's a wave that is an analog of the sound waves moving through the air. It's trying to be a faithful copy of the same variations. And then I turn those into a wiggling needle that cuts into a phonograph record. That's another analog of those same little wiggling waves. You sell that to somebody, they take it home and they put a needle in it and it spins around and it wiggles in those same little vibrations that are trying to vibrate in the same way as the original wave air was moving, and turn that into electricity which then goes to a speaker, which takes those electrical vibrations, turns them back into sound pressure vibrations, and moves the air again. So there's all these steps along the way from that original tuba to that loudspeaker, waveforms being captured and stored as other waveforms, little wiggles in the vinyl or moving through a circuit as electrical waveforms.
Well, basically, what I understand you to say is that we make wave vibrations either with our vocal cords or our tuba. They're stored on the long playing record.
As other wave vibrations.
As different forms. And then they're reproduced electronically to the speakers so that we could hear them just as if we were making the sounds with our vocal cords or our tuba.
Exactly.
Or viola.
You said that so much better than I could have. But the thing is that artifacts and distortions and things are introduced along the way. Phonograph records can be scratched. They're made of materials that maybe introduce a certain amount of noise as they're spinning around, things like that. Same with tape. Magnetic pulses are stored on little oxide particles. Remember, you used to take a piece of paper and put iron oxide filings on them and then use a magnet underneath.
Right.
Well, if you had a
right.
piece of paper that was infinitely long and moving along at a set speed, you could move that magnet up and down and make lots of little particle variations. And that's essentially what's going on with magnetic tape. Folks like me, always looking for another way to do things, came across this digital technology, which has its own problems, but it uses a radically different way of storing the information.
Well, Greg McVicker, tell us what the digital age is and perhaps explain what digital recording is.
Well, it's the change in the way that you do things that enables all kinds of other things to happen. Digital recording essentially maps a waveform mathematically using something called an analog to digital converter, A to D converter, just on a little chip. And it turns that varying waveform, that electronic analog of real organic sound, into a stream of numbers. A CD, for example, records 44.1 thousand samples per second. Each sample is a 16-bit number.
Stay there for a minute and explain what a 16-bit number is.
It's 16 zeros and ones. Each one is a bit, a little bit of information. It's either a zero or a one.
There's quite a few different combinations
yes.
that can be created. And each of those combinations represent a different tonal level.
They represent a different point on the waveform.
Each different point on the waveform sounds different to our ears.
Let's go to the ocean and think about that, the waves coming in. We're all familiar with that. The waves come in pulses. There's a wave, then there's not a wave, there's a trough, and then there's a wave, and there's a trough. We call that frequency. And the higher the frequency, our ears interpret that as higher pitch. A cymbal is a high frequency, a bass drum is a low frequency. So those low frequency waves are like big rolling slow waves. High frequency would be like lots of little ones close together. If you could see the waves, that's what they look like. If you're sampling a waveform 44.1 thousand times per second, you're going to be mapping all the little peaks and troughs and the sort of curves in between. Each sample doesn't really have any characteristics in terms of pitch or anything. It's just remembering where that waveform was at that moment, whether it was going fast or slow. Doesn't matter. Now, the other axis is the dynamics, how loud or how soft things are. Think of a cymbal. If you could see that waveform, there'd be a really loud peak at the beginning and then this sort of diminishing decay. When you talk about CDs, for example, 16-bit, each one of those bits is capable of recording and reproducing 6 dB of sound. 1 decibel is the smallest amount of variation of sound the human ear can hear, roughly, 1 to 2 decibels. Recording engineer people throw this around all the time. What decibels? Could you turn that up 2 dB or turn it down 5 dB, that kind of a thing? It's just sort of a measure of volume. Okay, a rock concert might be like 100 decibels. So if each bit is 16 dB, that gives a dynamic range of 8 times 6. That's 96. You're nodding your head. Something like that. dB range from 0, from the quietest quiet, no sound at all, to the loudest. That's a lot to work with. That's why classical recording engineers loved digital initially, because they could really capture the life of a symphony orchestra with those tremendous dynamics of loud, loud, loud crashing timpani and everything, and these very, very subtle
And additionally, digital can be modified more easily than analog.
Well, that's the thing, and that's where we're getting into the digital age thing. Once it's math, really, you just put a lot of smart people on the problem, and next thing you know, you'll think of all kinds of things you can do with these numbers. You can compress them down and make them more, make the files more compact and move them around, and that's where, you know, moving music on the internet came from. Everything from Napster to the iTunes store and file sharing, all those kinds of things. You can attach sound files to emails or post them on your website.
Well, a lot of that is known as MP3.
Well, MP3 is one particular type of compression.
What does MP3 stand for? An MP2, an MP1 and 4?
The motion picture something group, electronic group, I forget what the E is for, but it's an international standards body that gets together every year and decides what the standard is going to be. And thank heavens they do. We have these standards so that when I give you a file, it plays back in your software as well as it does in mine. And some are proprietary. You have to pay a fee to use them. Others aren't. But they're these standards, okay? So there's really MPEG 3 is MPEG 1 layer 3. It became known as MP3, but it's really MPEG 1 layer 3. There's also an MPEG 2 and MPEG. They skipped MPEG 3 because it would be too confusing and jumped to MPEG 4. So if you're familiar, your listeners are familiar with AAC files, which is a Dolby technology, MP4, M4A, they're called in iTunes. It's a better quality version of MP3.
Well, Greg McVicker, where are we going to go in the future with the digital abilities, the electronic digital abilities, both in audio and in picture?
Well, everything's getting smaller, faster, higher resolution, and more interconnected. It's almost unimaginable what can possibly happen. I've been watching HDTV lately, and it just blows my mind what's possible.
High-definition television, which allows us to see things with a much higher resolution, much more clarity between the color shifts and the images?
Everything about it, the actual resolution of the image as well as the color density, there's just more information there, and it's more lifelike. But that needs to be moved through communications channels, and there has to be equipment at either end in order to handle those signals. So to get back to your question, what's happening is there's just more sophistication, more technical sophistication, more interconnection, able to handle more detail, to deliver it across greater distances, share with more people with more affordable playback technology. And it's becoming more interactive. This is a key part of this, is that maybe not with high-def TV so much, but with other technologies having to do with the internet, especially, there's tremendous amount of interactivity that's possible, peer-to-peer kinds of things.
There's concern on the part of some people about the exposure to the electronic charges nearby and at a greater distance in community range in terms of all of the wireless technology. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You know, it's funny. Just yesterday, somebody sent me a link of all these videos from France, I think. And it's kids getting together, they're drinking and having a little party, and they put their cell phones together, three of them, the heads together in a little triangle, and then a fourth person calls all three numbers, and they put some little kernels of popcorn in between, and then watch as the phones answer and talk to the home base, the cell tower essentially. They emit a certain amount of microwave energy, and one by one, the little popcorn kernels pop. I can't vouch for the, you know, veracity of those videos or whatever, but it does bring home the point that we are dealing with microwaves and little transmitters, little radio transmitters, and we're putting them by our heads. So it's always a good idea to use some kind of headset device or something like that and keep those away from our brains. I would think that would be the biggest risk, you know, that we might be facing.
I would think there may be a risk, too, that many men carry the cell phone in a pocket or at waist level.
I would think so.
Women do that in a purse. Possible reproductive issues in the future and the next generation have some interesting mutations.
I think it'd be a good idea to measure these things. Let's get a meter out and measure it.
A meter of what is emitted from a cell phone that's carried in a person's pocket.
Let's measure it and then we know what we're talking about. You know, I've had friends that were deathly afraid of microwave ovens. And when they first came out, I was kind of afraid of them, too, and didn't want one in my house. And some of them did leak a little bit. Now I don't think they do, and I don't worry about it. So we don't want to be worrying about things that are not really a problem, but we do want to worry about things that are a problem. And one of the things people can keep in mind with phones is that the more far away you are from a cell, if you're in a rural area, something like that, where you really have to reach for a signal, or if you're in your car or in a building where it's having a hard time picking up a signal, it's going to turn up its transmitter. So if you're getting a pretty clear shot, it's going to work at a very low power.
When you say it, are you referring to the cell phone?
The cell phone itself, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. As opposed to the transmitter on the mountain.
Yeah, it only uses as much power as it needs to. It tries to conserve and use as little as possible. But if it's having a hard time picking up a signal, it will send out a stronger signal as well. So
in the greater the rural setting, the farther away you should be from the cell phone instrument and have a headphone piece.
I believe so. That's the way I would do it. I've seen people just sort of hold it up, you know, to get a good signal and use an earpiece.
Well, Greg McVicker, let's move to a different topic.
Okay.
And that would be a book that you're writing about digital radio and public radio use of digital equipment.
That's right. It's called Digital Audiocraft. It's almost finished. In fact, I'm working on the last chapter today. So it'll be out in a few months, and we're hoping that colleges will pick it up as a textbook. Over the years, Audiocraft by Randy Tom has been very popular as a workbook for people wanting to learn how to edit tape and use microphones and do all the things you need to do in order to make radio pieces. And Randy's brilliant. He's the guy that recorded the lightsaber sounds originally and came up with all kinds of fantastic sounds we've heard in many motion pictures, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and all these Lucas films and things that he's so good at. And I feel very, you know, honored to be a part of the team and writing the sequel to that called Digital Audiocraft. And we're just essentially helping people in community radio and in colleges and different places learn how to master these tools to be creative and contribute to the public conversation, essentially, with their own voice.
Well, there's two topics there. One is be creative, and two, the public conversation. Mm-hmm. So in terms of being creative, what do you hope to enhance and foment?
Well, I'm not sure if digital really is either here or there in terms of creativity.
But in the ease of production, it's here.
Yeah, it has its own strengths and weaknesses and benefits and roadblocks and things. But because things have become so inexpensive, it's pretty amazing the amount of quality one can just carry around in their pocket and hit a button and pick up a beautiful stereo recording of some birds or of a band or of an interview or something like that. So it is pretty revolutionary that way. I get these catalogs from broadcast suppliers all the time, and I look through them and I think, you know, this is the kind of thing I fantasized about when I was in college, and they didn't make these things. They didn't exist yet. But now there's 10 different versions of the same thing, and it's $200, $300, you know?
Something like the wristwatch radio that Dick Tracy wore that we now have in our pocket in terms of a cell phone.
It's amazing. I'm carrying around an iPhone. I can take pictures with it, and I can send them. I can post them directly to my website with a couple of clicks. And so there's this whole thing of citizen journalism that's coming along as well, which we should mention.
The public conversation.
Yeah. Whether people continue to go through these, what we would call point-to-mini-point, a radio station, which is, you know, it's got its tower and it's sort of, it's a bottleneck, really. Only certain people get on the air. And then many people hear this one signal. That's point-to-mini-point. There's many-to-many going on with the Internet, where everyone can have a website if they want to, or a blog or something like that, and have the conversation move more as a mesh than as a hub or a hub-and-spoke topology like we're used to. The tools that we're teaching people about work really for either. It doesn't really matter. You know, once you learn how to record an interview, edit it in a way that strengthens the material and brings it into focus, put it into a file format that works for whatever you're trying to do. But then you can do many things with it. You can broadcast it. You can podcast. Because so many people can do it, it has a many-to-many characteristic to it.
Do you have any thoughts on the social changes, both micro and macro, that are evolving and may evolve in the future by the wide accessibility to the public conversation?
Well, we used to talk about the info-rich and the info-poor and techno-peasants and things like that, this whole idea of the great digital divide. Of course, that still exists. Whether it will always exist, I don't know. The price of internet access and the price of computers, whether they be new ones or used ones, there's plenty of good used ones floating around, is dropping so rapidly that it's getting to the point where people in villages and really living in kind of Stone Age conditions can have access to the internet. I mean, nobody can predict exactly what this is going to mean, but it has a vast transforming effect, so much so that repressive governments have tried to throttle certain kinds of internet communication. Of course, China comes to mind. And I guess they're having some success at that. Although what's interesting about the internet, you may know this, it was developed by people involved in the nuclear age, and they were concerned about what if a whole city was bombed or many cities were bombed. How would American infrastructure, communications infrastructure, survive? Because it was a very centralized, hierarchical system where you had, you know, you have your phone building downtown, and that connects to a regional one, and then that connects to a long-distance center, and all someone has to do is drop a bomb on one of those, and you can wipe out a lot of communications, and it can't really be routed around very effectively. With the internet, which uses little bits, little packets of bits that sort of flow almost like through a delta of different streams and rivulets and canals and things, they can reassemble. They can kind of be routed in a way that they swarm back together and reassemble in another place. So if one part of the internet is damaged, everything just routes around it automatically. That was designed as a survival tactic in case of mass nuclear attack of some kind. But what it means now, which is kind of ironic, is that if a repressive government tries to stop parts of the internet, it will route around. It's sort of self-healing that way.
If someone wants to buy a used laptop, for instance, do you have some thoughts on what they should look for and what they should avoid when shopping?
Well, I wouldn't overpay. There's a lot of people that want to recapture, you know, I love this machine. I wrote some books on it. It's fantastic. Well, yeah, it was. And maybe it's not worth that much anymore because new ones do come out at lower and lower prices. It's kind of a counterintuitive, you know, the economics of things are getting cheaper all the time. New things are getting cheaper, but they are. So when you're making that calculation, you want to look at the used and look at the new and see, looking ahead for the next couple of years, what's going to serve my purposes. And don't overbuy. In many cases, just a used laptop or something that's 2 or 3 years old will do more than everything you need to do. Email, web browsing, uploading some photographs and things like that, putting some music on it, that kind of thing. But if your needs are a little more sophisticated, you're spending a lot of time on Photoshop and whatnot, then you want to look at a faster machine because your time is worth something too. So you need to do this sort of equation and think, you know, what's my time worth? That's why people that use computers for their living, time is money, and they'll turn over their computers and get new ones every couple of years, or certainly every 3 years, because that advantage, that edge of getting the latest processors and hard drives and, you know, communication speeds and everything makes a difference. And it's worth pursuing. But I would say if you're just doing email and some web stuff, really, just about anything will work if it's in reasonably good shape. And I would also make sure you have a friend or a family member that can sort of be your, if you're new to this, it's like the friend down the street that can help you fix your car, you know, that kind of a thing. I'm a big Mac head because I like Macintosh because it's easy to, the cost of ownership is very low. It's easy to maintain. Windows can be very complicated, although some people have great luck with it. Make sure that you're surrounded by people that can support you.
Well, Greg McVicker, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
One is, can you tell us an important concept that you've learned recently, important to you on any level?
Wow. Well, this is certainly not a new concept. It's probably an ancient concept. And I had heard it before, but I'm trying to apply it more now because I really see the beauty of it. And that is that when in doubt, kindness is the best response.
And can you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
I was very intrigued by a book. I haven't quite finished it yet, but it's called The Earth is Flat by Thomas Friedman. I know some people go, oh, Thomas Friedman, didn't he support the war or something like that? But he's got this interesting perspective of international business and how things that we always thought were local or somehow the unique province of our economy are now being jobbed out everywhere. For example, the Bangalore telemarketing technical service bureaus and things like that. But there's a lot of other services, just about any other service here. X-rays, for example, may be examined by somebody in Pakistan or India at night and not in your local hospital because of this cheap telecommunications, high resolution, cheap computing power, and educational systems that might be better than ours.
Well, Greg McVicker, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It's been my pleasure.
Greg McVicker is the host and producer of UndercurrentsRadio.net and directs Radio Camp, which may be found at RadioCamp.com. The book that he recommends is The Earth is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century by Thomas L. Friedman. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious may be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org, and they're available by mail in CD format for $12 each. Our address is Post Office Box 7 in Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. And we do appreciate hearing from you with ideas, suggestions, and comments about our programming. And you do have the address. Our phone is 707-462-6541. And the email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.